everybody. This is Phil Town.
And this is Danielle Town.
And welcome to the Invested Podcast, where we are figuring out how to invest like the best investors in the world. And by the way, by that, we very specifically mean people who invest.
Let us now define.
As opposed to speculate. There are phenomenal speculators out there, some of whom own baseball teams, and football teams, but that's not what we do. What we're trying to do, what we intend to do, is make sure that we know that the companies that we buy, or whatever we buy, whether it's a bicycle at a flea sale or, you know, a flea market or a house or anything else, whatever we buy, we know we'll be able to sell it for more in 10 years.
Yeah,
that's
totally
fundamental definition.
Totally. And I love that you always say that it can be anything, because we talk so much about public companies because that's what's accessible to most of us small investors. But it really helps me to think about it like, no, it really can be anything. It can be the apartment down the street. It can be a private company. It can be your own business that you're running. I've had people tell me they use these principles to manage their own businesses better, which is so smart.
I think it's one of the smartest things you can do, actually.
Totally. And it can be, you know, buying a bike that you know is worth a bunch, and the person you're buying it from doesn't know that. It can be that. So yep. Lots of things.
And the idea that you could have specific criteria that you build a business around, criteria that someone like us would use to buy that business, might be a really smart idea if you think about it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're looking for great businesses, and great businesses have some very clear definitions, right? The most important thing in a great business is that it has a very large moat that protects it from competition. It's a niche business that can protect that niche. And if you build a business that doesn't have a niche, essentially what you're doing is competing on price. And so you really want to think about whether you're building your own businesses or whether you're buying into somebody else's. The criteria is very, very similar, if not exactly identical. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what we think about. And, excuse me.
But you were going to say, I thought, who the great investors were or are.
Well, yes, they are.
Who are they?
Ben Graham, who invented value investing, wrote the Bible of value investing back in 1934, called Security Analysis with David Dodd as their professors at Columbia University. And that basic style of investing didn't exist before Ben laid it all out there. I'm sure somebody did it, but you know, nobody laid it out clearly how you go about doing something like that. And it starts with the basic assumption that the market is inefficient. Whatever market that you're in, whether it's real estate, flea markets, or stocks, that there's an inefficiency in the market. And that inefficiency means that from time to time, things will be priced above their value or below their value. They won't be priced properly because somebody's not paying attention or gotten emotional, or there's fear or there's greed, and things get out of hand. Okay, so we know this about bubbles, right? We get into bubbles in the stock market or in real estate. Mm-hmm. We've seen that in our lifetime. And that just is an inefficiency. It means that people are not paying attention to the actual value of what they're buying. And that you have the opposite of bubbles. You have a collapse of a market, which means the same thing, that fear has taken over and people aren't paying attention to what they're selling things for. They're just getting out. And so we're looking for those kind of inefficiencies. Ben invented that and wrote out how you go about doing that. His second book, called The Intelligent Investor, is thought by Warren Buffett to be the best book ever written about investing.
I will say it is more readable than Security Analysis.
It is.
Just as a side tip.
And neither one of them are easy.
No.
So along come authors like, you know, Guy Spier, who wrote Education of a Value Investor, and Manish Prabhai, who wrote Dondo Investing. And these are books that are tried to explain from the author's point of view how to go about doing that. And then you and I wrote a book called Invested, which,
well, I was going to say Rule Number One's a pretty good book about how to do that.
And it's still out there in the bookshelves, by the way. That's amazing. It's been 13 years and it's still there, 14 years now. So that's really exciting. And so we've written some books to try to help investors figure this out, you know? And so, but it all comes back to Graham. And then we probably wouldn't know that much about Ben Graham because he's very academic and the books are very academic, you know, business school kinds of books. And we're not business school necessarily investors, except that Warren Buffett became Ben Graham's disciple and became the best investor in the world by far. He and Charlie Munger basically have been teaching us since 1995 or 1955 how they've gone about investing. And Warren's written a letter every year that goes into great detail about how to do this kind of investing. Mm-hmm. So we're not making stuff up. I mean, it's coming right from the fountain of knowledge about this. And we just want to constantly give him credit and hope that he lives to be 150, because every time he speaks, I learn more.
Me too. And
every time Charlie speaks, we learn more. It's extraordinary how brilliant these guys are and how they get to the heart of investing. And we're trying to unfold that in a way that everybody out there listening to the podcast can understand. And there's it's amazing to me as we dig deeper into this that so many of the people that write about how Buffett and Munger invest don't necessarily do it exactly that way. And
well, I think it's natural for people to find their own way, don't you?
I do, and I guess I'm thinking the people, most of the people who write books about this are also managing other people's money. And as we've unfolded here in the podcast many times, there is a pressure on money managers that is very difficult to push back against. It's very difficult not to be overwhelmed by what Warren Buffett calls the institutional imperative. And by that he means the fact that if you're a batter and playing baseball and you're standing at the plate, you've got all of these investors up, or you've got all these fans up there who are your investors. You got all these fans up there who are watching you try to hit the ball. And if you stand there with the bat on your shoulder, watching one pitch after another go by in this game of investing, looking at one stock after another and not buying anything, after a while, those fans start to get a little antsy. And Warren says it's like really hard up there at the batter's box when you hear people yelling, "Swing, you bum!"
This is reminding me that we did an entire episode where you tried to explain this baseball analogy to me. And the whole episode was just you being like, "More baseball," and me being like, "That makes no sense." You guys can go back and listen to it. I think it's called something like fat pitch.
That's right.
It was a bit of a mess.
It's brilliant. No, it was brilliant. It was brilliant.
It was a bit of a mess.
I love this metaphor, and not only because Buffett uses it all the time and has a picture of Ted Williams on his wall. So I think it's a very good metaphor, because it's very hard for fund managers. I mean, I'm talking about really good ones, including Warren and Charlie, to not swing the bat.
I mean, I think it's hard for all of us to not swing the bat. Like, there are those pressures, but I also think, you know, those of us just investing our own money feel a lot of those pressures, you know, just that we get so many questions about that. Like, oh, I'm sitting in cash. I've been in cash for a long time. Should I stay there?
It's
like,
getting scary.
We feel the pressure. It doesn't, when it comes from other people, it's probably worse, but I think it's the same for anybody trying to make investing decisions.
So
at
something
its core.
On that I think is worth diving into right here at the beginning of the year. Because everybody feels that kind of pressure, agreed. And there are some things that help me, at least, that help me step back from the pressure. And I thought I'd kind of go into a couple of those today.
All right. So new year, new PBT, new year, new you, new Phil Town. What to do when you are feeling the pressure.
And what to do in this market, where it's very, very interesting stock market right now. Very different than we've seen it in a long, 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 long time. And so I thought I'd kind of dive into this a little bit, because although Warren and Charlie say they don't look at the market, they're not influenced by the market itself, The fact of the matter is that when you can't find great companies that are on sale at all, you just can't, which is the case right now for Buffett. He's having a really rough time, and there's pressure from shareholders to do something with $120 billion that they say, you could give it back to us. You could give us the cash in a form of a dividend. Well, he's feeling the heat more than maybe ever. He certainly has way more cash on hand than he's ever had by more than double. And I know that there have been times in the past when he's gotten out of the market and stayed out of the market for a good chunk of time, in spite of the fact that the market's still going up. And he's, and that's one of these things right now. He's in one of those right now. And it is not easy. So I thought I would share a couple of things. One is a tool that Warren said that he uses, although he said it almost 20 years ago and hasn't said a word about it since. So we don't know.
Okay, so wait
sure.
a second. So these are tools to do what?
Tools to help you understand why you're not seeing a lot of great companies available to buy.
Oh, interesting. Okay, that's not what I thought you were going to say. So tools to help you understand why you're waiting.
Yeah.
Okay.
They give me some confidence in my process. Because my process is find businesses I understand, make sure they have a moat, make sure I like the management, and buy them on sale. And buy them on sale, as we've described in great detail, in Invested, means particularly get them with a 10% yield on cash, right?
Mm-hmm.
Buy them so that the money you pay is 10 times the cash flow coming off of that business. And so that criteria means, and has been a valid criteria for over 100 years, that criteria means that, or indicates today, that it's very hard to find those kind of companies. There are just hardly any around at that kind of pricing. So it helps to understand why, all right? Or it helps to understand, if not why, at least that's reflected in the overall market. And we've talked about these tools before, but I wanted to go into them a little bit more at the beginning of the year here. The tool
cool.
that Buffett
okay,
talked
so
about.
Okay, so what's the tool that Buffett talks about?
It's called the Wilshire GDP ratio.
Ah, we have talked about this many times.
Well, there's nothing new under the sun in this podcast. Everything is laid out in the first podcast with Charlie in 1 minute. So
that's
everything
true.
Else is
And then
just
in a 250-page book that we wrote.
Exactly.
But I think we come up with new ideas all the time. So,
well, we certainly have a lot of amplification that can run in new ways of thinking about things. But these tools right here have been around a long time. And as I said, Buffett talked about it, I think, in Forbes or Fortune magazine back in 2001, where he went into detail about the Wilshire GDP ratio. So let me just say what it is real quick.
Yeah. Okay.
Although you already know, right?
Well, I know what it is, but, you know,
okay,
what
so
you're
going to
say, I don't know.
This is statistics being kept by the Federal Reserve in St. Louis, and their abbreviation is the FRED, F-R-E-D. That's the St. Louis Federal Reserve. And if you go to their website, or if you just Google FRED Wilshire GDP, and Wilshire is W-I-L-S-H-I-R-E, FRED Wilshire GDP, this chart will come up. It's called the Wilshire 5000 Total Market Full Cap Index / Gross Domestic Product, which is Wilshire GDP. So the Wilshire 5000
So it's a ratio, just to be clear. It's a ratio of the Wilshire 5000, which is a collection of stocks, which is supposed to be basically the whole U.S. market. And it's called the Wilshire 5000, but I don't think there are actually 5,000 stocks in it anymore.
No.
I think it's more like 3,500 because I looked it up.
Oh, and just the policies of regulation and the Sarbanes-Oxley Act have put a real dampening on the willingness of companies to go public and submit themselves to that kind of public scrutiny and regulatory scrutiny. And as a result, over the last, 15 years or so, we've gone from 9,000 public companies to about 4,500 total.
Mm-hmm.
And companies aren't going public at anywhere near the rate. I think they're going public at about half the rate that they used to.
Yeah, it's slowed down a lot. So this ratio is of those companies
that are out there
to the GDP of the U.S., which is gross domestic product of the U.S.
Right, which is the revenue of all of the goods and services sold.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like U.S. sales.
Yeah.
Right? And U.S. sales are running, I don't know, ballpark-ish, $20 trillion. Well, it's probably 18 or something like that, but let's call it $20
trillion. I'll go with whatever you say, because I have no idea.
Give or take $1 or $2 trillion, no big thing. And that is divided into, so that's the denominator, and that's divided into the total value of the market, total price of the market, which means take all the stock shares of a company times their stock price, and then do that for every single company in the Wilshire 5000 index, which is almost all the companies, and you get a total amount of money. And it might be, let's just ballpark it at $30 trillion, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Let's just say. Okay. So you divide $20 trillion from GDP into $30 trillion of Wilshire, and you'd get 1.5
mm-hmm.
or 150%.
So the idea, right, is that the idea behind the ratio is to see if stocks actually are reflecting what is being sold by companies in the U.S.
If stock prices.
Stock prices, right, exactly. Right.
Now, in order to have this be a useful tool, we would want to look and see, well, what have stock prices as a group been relative to GDP in the past, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when the market was super cheap, what did that look like? When we know historically you could have bought a lot of companies at a cheap price and you would have done really well with them over time, like back in the 70s, let's say, what did that ratio look like then? And so that's pretty useful to know that it was ranging between, 20% and 40%.
Okay.
Sorry. So 20 to 40% all through the 70s, through the early 80s, all the way to 1990s. It was always 40% or lower.
Meaning that stock prices, or let's say the Wilshire, was 40% of the GDP.
Right. So if GDP is $20 trillion, if we had 40% stock, if stock prices were 40% of GDP, they would be at $8 trillion.
Mm-hmm. So that was cheap, quote unquote.
That would have been cheap, and that would be cheap today.
Okay.
Okay. And then in late 1990s, the Federal Reserve started getting very active in interest rates. And the market started getting very expensive and things took off and it got clear up. The ratio got clear up to 120% by 1999.
Mm. So that was the crazy stock market bubble of the dot-com era.
True. True. So in 2001, Buffett came out and said, well, look, if the market gets up frothy above 100%, something like that of GDP, it's getting frothy and it gets up 120, it starts to be a red flag.
Mm-hmm.
And you should be worried, right, that the market's not going to stay there because historically it's never been able to sustain that level of pricing relative to the sales of the country.
Mm-hmm.
So the Wilshire GDP ratio that Buffett talks about is pretty average over a long period of time of around, you know, if stocks are at 80% of Wilshire GDP, if the ratio is 80%, that's a pretty viable market. Below 80% is real viable. 40% super viable. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to find some deals out there at that kind of pricing. Okay. But when you get above 100%, it starts to become fully priced. The whole market is fully priced. You get above 120%, it's starting to get expensive. Okay. And right now, we are at, I believe, 170%.
Oh, wow. It's gone up since we last talked about it.
Yeah. It's now at 173.
Well, of course it has. Of course it has, because the market's gone up dramatically.
Right. So we're higher than
I've ever seen. What did you say? I missed what was the number?
173%.
Jeez.
173. So 173, that's a long way from 20.
Mm-hmm.
right? Mm-hmm. And so that's the first thing that gives us an indication of why we can't find anything. It's because the whole market is massively expensive relative to historical pricing. And then, of course, we could look at macro reasons why. And that's the number one, is that interest rates are extremely low and being held down. And there's no place to go to get a yield on your money that'll give you much. So people are putting their money in the stock market. All right. So that's the Wilshire GDP.
What I like about that particular resource is that you can look back historically and you don't have to worry about adjusting the value for inflation because it's all constant.
Right.
So good it's just straightforward. Like, here are the numbers. Here's the ratio, because the ratio will be within its own year. So it's, yeah, I didn't know it had gone that high. Yeah, it's just
far out there, man. It's like, okay, well, where can this go from here? 200%, 300%.
I don't see why not. It's already untethered from reality. So
exactly.
I really don't see why it can't go to 300%. We'll be sitting here going, it's at 300% now. Wow, that's amazing. And there's really nothing else to say.
And that is a really good indication of getting near the top.
Maybe. I mean, we're at 170, so we're nowhere near the top if the top is 300, right? Oh,
and by the way, I should admit here that from about 2016 till now, it's been completely crazy.
Yeah.
So we're already 4 years into crazy.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
So pretty hard to say it won't be 300%.
Right.
And if you're sitting in a mutual fund and have money in a 401k and are broadly diversified in the market, and you're listening to us talk about this thing as being a dangerous place to be invested, red flags all over the place. And so you get out into cash and 3 years from now, it's at 300%. You are going to hate us.
Yeah. And you're probably going to lose your job. I'm sorry to tell you.
Probably. But I only know how to do this game the one way, right? I only know how to do what's been successful in the past. And if the rules have changed that much, then there's nothing much I can do about it.
I don't believe in
buying that stuff.
No, and that's why I made the point that it's not tethered to reality, because at some point, and this is what I love about what you've taught me about investing in companies, at some point it has to become retethered, because companies create cash, companies create money, companies exist off of profit, or at least revenue. And at some point, it has to get to the point where if there's no more money to be paying off the bills, we come back to reality. It falls back to earth.
I don't think America gets to be Argentina exactly. With that, I mean that Argentina has a habit of solving its monetary problems, paying its debt, by just printing more pesos.
Yeah.
And that works for a little while. You know, people will take the pesos at face value until they start to realize, wow, wages are going up, prices are going up. I need more pesos here. Mm-hmm. So what comes from this kind of thing typically and ultimately is some sort of inflationary response, where there has been too much easy money, too much money put into the economy, and eventually people refuse to take those dollars. But American dollars are unique in the world. We're the world's reserve currency, which means everybody, all the banks around the world have to hold dollars. And further, our presidents, both Obama and Trump, I guess even Bush at the very end of his administration, then Obama and now Trump, have been extremely aggressive at solving the problem of deflation, much more aggressive than any other country in the world,
I was wondering why you left Clinton out. I think Clinton did okay at that too, no?
Clinton did very well with the budget, but in a different time. And what has happened to us in 2009 at the end of the Bush administration was an absolute collapse of the financial
sector. Oh, you meant the second Bush. Sorry.
Yeah, Bush too.
I was thinking, like, why are you going all the way back to the first George? I forgot there was a second one. Yes. Bush number two. Got it.
Bush number two jumped in and under, I believe it was Greenspan, but I might be wrong.
I think Greenspan was still there. Yeah,
started dropping interest rates and pouring money into the economy, which is a desperate measure, and it to a degree worked. And we didn't fall into a depression in 2009, which we probably would have had they not done that. And then Obama followed up, Obama's Federal Reserve followed up under Bernanke and kept that rocking. Bernanke had written a very important textbook on the depression and believed very strongly that the mistake that FDR made was to tighten up money in the wrong time, 1938, or we would have come out of the depression. And so he kept it going, dropping interest rates and aggressively putting money into the economy to the tune of $4 trillion over a couple of years through the Federal Reserve. And that helped the economy stabilize, but it still didn't stimulate it. And so Obama went through 8 years of sort of staggering through a slushy economy with, you know, better unemployment all the time, but wages not going up. And then Trump came in and cut taxes aggressively, and interest rates have stayed very low. And that combination has now started to raise wages. So we're starting to see a little inflation now, especially on the bottom of wages. People who we know who run huddle houses and waffle houses, who employ people at a very low wage, are having a terrible time finding people who will work for that low wage. Their good workers have left and gone to better jobs with higher wages. And this is how it starts. When you start to squeeze wages, you'd like to see the bottom of the wage pile start to move up, and you like to see the people who pay the least for employees to have to raise their prices, because there's a bottom of the barrel employee that nobody wants.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's inflation in real life. So yeah. To get the better employees, they have to pay more, which means they have to raise their prices. And that's what we all see as inflation.
Exactly. And that's what everybody's been trying to get at the Federal Reserve. And for three presidencies has been trying to get the middle class and lower class wages up. And it hasn't happened, but it's starting to happen now. And then the question is, can you put the brakes on at the right time without throwing us into a depression and killing the goose? And yet not so late that you go into massive inflation and become Argentina. It's dicey out there right now.
Yeah. Okay. Now, before we get to the next methodology, which we might have to get to next time, we got a really good question. Over Christmas from a family member when we were talking about this, because of course we spend our Christmases talking about monetary policy now in the townhouse. Not all of us love it.
As much as
it's
you
true.
And I do.
But it was a good question. And the question was, to what you were just saying, when you say, oh, the government put all this money, put $4 trillion into the economy, how did they like literally do that? How did they logistically create money and put it, quote unquote, into the economy? And you gave a good answer. So, maybe you can explain it here.
Sure. So in the old days, back before digital stuff, if you wanted to put more money into the economy, you printed paper and then you handed it out.
Hoping that was the answer. Just stand at the steps of the Treasury and get some money. The government's right. Handing out.
Right, which is sort of what happens, weirdly. today, you can do it just by having a digital entry into the Federal Reserve debit and credit right into their ledger, which says that, okay, so we now are borrowing $4 trillion from the American people. And to borrow that, we have the power of a bank to simply put in to our bank account at the Federal Reserve $4 trillion.
So when you say they used to literally print the money, what you meant is they would print the money and then sort of borrow it, like put it on the books as a loan, but that they did actually print it. And now you're saying it's on the books as a loan. They just don't actually print it because now everything's done by computer.
Exactly. So they go, okay, well, now we, the Federal Bank for the People, owe the people $4 trillion. And we just make an entry that we have $4 trillion that we didn't have a minute ago.
Okay.
Now, to put that in perspective, the value of the entire stock market, remember, we just said was ballparkish about, you know, $30 trillion. So we just created about, you know, 1/7 of the value of the entire U.S. stock market just because we felt like it, like it'd be a good idea.
Well, so that's yeah, it wasn't because we felt like it. It was because we thought it would be a good idea.
Well, we've rationally determined that it's a good idea. We need to do this. Very definitely, we need to do this. All right. Now, how does the money get out
Into
the public? Well, the federal government needs to have money to operate. And they run at a deficit. They operate with spending more money than they have. So in order to spend money you don't have, even if you're the federal government, you have to borrow it from somebody because the federal government can't create money.
Which, by the way, I didn't know when I was a kid. When I was a kid and you listen to the news and they say things like, the deficit is $7 trillion. It's like, all right. So they just sort of didn't have that. At some point, like I really didn't know until I was basically a young adult and actually like read about it, that they actually have to borrow that money. I just thought governments could make it up. So it's good that they can't just make it up. They have to borrow the money.
Right. And the arm of the government.
You're like, I raised an idiot. So
no, it's not. It's
inflation,
not simple.
Government borrowing. I didn't know how any of it works.
But this is how it works in the U.S., right? They just put the money on the books at the Federal Reserve on their say-so. The federal government doesn't get to tell them what to do. You can see the President of the United States jumping up and down and telling the Federal Reserve, lower your interest rates, but they didn't have to do it.
Yeah.
Right?
Thank goodness they're separated.
Their job is to be independent of the federal government and to do what they think is right to keep employment up. So
regardless,
they create
elections.
This $4 trillion. And then the federal government goes to an auction where it says, we want to auction off a bunch of treasury bills, which just means we are going to borrow money from the market. And they give that auction to companies like Goldman Sachs. So Goldman Sachs, big institutional bank, says, okay, we will conduct an auction for you, the federal government. You have, let's say... Just say even numbers. You've got $4 trillion you want to borrow. All right.
Okay.
And our job is to set the interest rate for that by going to the market and finding out what interest rate will the market be willing to get in order to give you $4 trillion. So Goldman goes out there and starts looking for buyers of these treasury bills, people who are going to lend the money to the government, and says, well, will you take 1%? No, 1% is not enough. How about 2%? No way. Okay, 2.5, maybe. 2.75. Okay, I've got some bidders here at 2.75. All right, now we only got rid of a few hundred million at 2.75. How about 2 and what's bigger than 3/4? Is it like 7/8? 2.875%. And now I've got $1 trillion is gone. Okay, so that it's an auction, just like that. But of course, the increments are much, much smaller in real life because there's all these people out there who are bidding all the time, weekly, basically, to do this. All right, so now the Federal Reserve wants to get $4 trillion into the market. What's it do? Oh, well, it just goes over to the auction and says, I'll take $4 trillion worth right now.
What?
Yeah, they bid. In the auction.
On their own auction.
On Goldman Sachs's auction.
Of money that they just loaned.
Of money that the Federal Reserve wants to get into the economy. So the easiest way for them to do that is to just go to the auction and lend the money and get a treasury note in return.
Right. I'm so confused. Okay, now I'm confused now. So the way I understand it is that the Treasury goes and creates these loans and they go and they issue the loans and that is how people then loan the government money and that is how they create this money that comes out into the world, into the economy, not necessarily to the market exactly, but just into the economy in general.
All right, let's make sure we know how all the different players here. So there's the federal government, which needs money to play with.
Yeah.
Needs money to run its defenses, pay Social Security, all that stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right, that's the federal government. Then that's a whole different entity is the Federal Reserve Bank. They're independent of the federal government.
Yeah, but the Fed doesn't issue debt. The Treasury Department does.
Right.
The Treasury Department issues Treasury bills.
Right. So the Treasury bills are created by the federal government and are exchanged to lenders.
Yeah.
And those lenders are often private lenders, right? People buy Treasury bills all the time for their 401ks.
Right. So I must have said it confusingly because that's what I was trying to say.
Okay. So that's right so far. And so somebody is conducting an auction in the middle here between your 401k money market account that wants to buy Treasury notes and the government that wants to sell them and get the money. And the guys in the middle there might be Goldman Sachs or Salomon or whoever, right? Mm-hmm. So they're in the middle. Now, one potential bidder in this auction, besides the guys who run your 401k and want to do money market account stuff, mm-hmm. would be the Federal Reserve Bank itself.
Okay, that's where I was confused. I thought you were saying that the Treasury Department was issuing the notes and then going around and buying the notes back. Mm-hmm. Which didn't make any sense to me. But you were saying the Treasury Department issues the notes and the Fed goes and buys them.
Right.
Got it.
So the Fed creates $4 trillion obligation that it owes the American people. And then that money then goes to the federal government via this auction to buy Treasury bills. And then the Federal Reserve puts those Treasury bills on its books as an asset. So the books balance in the Federal Reserve. It owes $4 trillion, and it has $4 trillion obligation from the federal government sitting right there in the form of $4 trillion worth of T-bills.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Fed's balanced, and the federal government is in a deficit spending. They owe the money and have to pay it. And now, think about it, that money, that $4 trillion, was not in the economy at all a minute ago. And now the federal government has $4 trillion that wasn't in the economy that it now spends and it goes into the economy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's how suddenly we have $4 trillion more than we did before.
Yeah. And as you pointed out, like 401k, you know, mutual funds will buy it. Like it's not just the government. It's also smaller institutions will buy these things. Right. And that's another way of getting it out into the economy.
Exactly. And then, those small institutions are not adding any new money to the economy. They're just using old money that was already there. So, the money in your 401k isn't new money.
That's true.
It's old money.
That's true.
Right. So just this new money coming in comes from the Federal Reserve. Now, the Federal Reserve also can go to individual institutional banks and buy their debt. So they lend out $4 trillion from Goldman Sachs, they lend it out all over the place, and people owe them this money, then Goldman can sell that to the Federal Reserve if the Federal Reserve wants those debts. And this is how the Federal Reserve helped banks get out of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
They bought crappy notes from them.
Mm-hmm. Good that point.
Ultimately would be paid off, but are in trouble at that moment. So that's another way that they could get trillions of dollars into the economy.
God, it's just all like balance sheet.
Oh, it's magic. Such a balancing act. And that's why it's getting a little scary when we're getting up into this part of the act where historically we've only been a handful of times before. And what tends to follow, what has followed historically in every case, is a collapse of the economy, at least into a major recession, if not a depression. And so that's the balancing act, is to keep us from falling into that.
So happy new year, everybody.
Happy new year.
Aren't you glad you pressed play?
Look on the bright side of life. Da-da, da-da, da-da.
Okay.
Now, the bright side of this actually is that they will be talking as we go along about how to prepare yourself and and be in a position where you can benefit from.
Well, I want to hear the next method.
We'll do that next
time. Of determining how to know if you should keep waiting with your money. Yeah,
there's another really good thing to look at. All right, we'll do that next time.
I can only assume we all have already heard before. But no,
we have.
Oh. Yeah.
But it's new for 2020.
It's new for 2020, and we can discover new things as we have today. All right. Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Go play. See you.
Hi, guys. Thanks for listening to Invested. If you enjoyed this episode and you want more information, including show notes and more episodes, visit us at investedpodcast.com. There's a special offer waiting for podcast listeners to attend my 3-day investing workshop absolutely free. So just head to investedpodcast.com. Everything discussed on this podcast is either my opinion or Danielle's opinion and is not to be taken as investing advice, because I am not your investment advisor, nor have I considered your personal situation as your fiduciary. This podcast is for your entertainment and education only, and I hope you enjoyed it.